What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Minute Productions presents Guide for the Film Fanatic, the podcast where we invite a guest to pick one movie from Danny Perry's seminal 1986 film reference book and talk to us about that movie. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hall.
A quick bit of business before we introduce our guests. We wanted to do some quick plugs for friends of the show, specifically authors who came on last season to promote books and somehow have new other entire ass books out since then. So starting on episode 10, John Beasdale joined us to discuss his book on Terrence Malick and Days of Heaven. A few months back, he released Darkness Visible, the cinema of Jonathan Glazer. And then, on top of that, just a couple weeks ago, he put out another book, Connery, which is a speculative novel about Sean Connery. So pick that up as well. On episode 13, Grady Hendrix and Chris Pagali discussed Enter the Dragon, Five Fingers of Death, and their book, These Fists Break Bricks. Chris's collaboration with our friend Michael Gingold, Armies of the Night, The Warriors and Its Legacy, is on shelves now. Highly recommended. And finally, the great Stephen Rebello joined us on episode 17 to discuss Hitchcock's Strangers on a Train and his book about it, Crisscross. At the end of that episode, he told us about his then forthcoming book, Hitchcockian Thrillers, Must-See Films in the Style of the Suspense Master, and that book is out now. You'll find links to purchase all of those in the show notes. Okay, to the matter at hand, our guest today is a co-host and critic for NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. She previously wrote and edited for the New York Times and Slate and hosted the podcast Represent. Her acclaimed book, Wannabe, Reckonings with the Pop Culture That Shapes Me, is now out in paperback. Folks, say hello to our good friend, Aisha Harris. Hi, Aisha.
Hello. It's so lovely to be here. Thank you.
We're so happy to have you. It's always nice to have guests from the old show come on to the new one. When we spoke to you last, Wannabe was finished, but it was not yet published.
Yes.
So catch us up. How was the experience of putting out, you know, a first book, first of all, but especially one that is as personal as that one was?
Wow. So this was now going on almost 3 years ago, which feels like a lifetime ago. Mm-hmm. So like so much has happened. but yeah, it was a fun experience. It was an exhausting experience. You know, it's weird now because I will see people, especially like at other events or other things or on social media, and they'll say things to me about like my personal life that I forget that I put in the book. I'm like, oh, you know these things about me.
Because I did share that, didn't
yeah,
I?
Yeah, I did yeah. write that.
Yeah.
So there's that. But yeah, it's been a good experience, and I'm glad it got a paperback release, and it seems to have resonated with a lot of people. And so, you know, I'm glad to be, you know, have it in the rearview mirror, and people keep asking, are you going to write another book? I don't know. I'm still kind of scarred from writing the first book. Mm-hmm. But for now, I'm just happy to say that I can call myself an author. So I'm sure that's something you can relate to, Jason.
No, I mean, definitely. Yeah. But I know what you mean about when people ask, because it is weirdly, not to minimize the other experience, but it is sort of like after you have a child, where it's like the whole process is so true. You cannot imagine doing it again. And then just enough time passes that you forget all of the literal labor pains in the latter case. You mentioned that it felt like a lifetime. And I want to drill down on that for just a moment. As the host of Pop Culture Happy Hour, you have to have your finger on the collective pulse in ways that not everyone does.
Yeah.
That some of us try to even avoid anymore. I know this is kind of a big question, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts about where pop culture is at in a moment of such intense political turmoil, divisiveness. Is it bringing us together? Is it polarizing us further? Is it just sort of coexisting? Like, where does it fit in these sort of raucous times?
Yes, and I feel like the answer, I don't know. I think there's definitely the monoculture is dead feeling. It's like we're all, we've all kind of gone off into our corners, and that's where we live and that's where we find our people and whatnot. One of the great things about the internet, but also one of the less great things about the internet.
Right.
I also think it's the type of thing where you're like, I don't think we'll understand this moment until at least 5 to 10 years from now. Just like, I think we're still trying to grapple with 2020, and I don't even know if we've done that. I mean, we've seen some filmmakers like, you know, what's his name? We did Eddington.
Ari Aster.
Yeah, Ari Aster. We've seen, you know, Begonia. We've seen people kind of try to parse those things together. And I think it's, so I myself am not necessarily ready to go back to 2020.
No,
yet and
relive. It still feels very raw. It still feels very much like an open wound.
Yeah, but then there's a lot of people who pretend that it like never happened. So right. I think there are certain people who are trying to meet the moment, and I think there are certain filmmakers and creators who are trying to meet the moment. At the same time, I do feel as though pop culture is just kind of in this weird space right now where everything seems to be repeating itself and everything, like, I don't know how much new there is there outside of like a handful of things. And I do also just worry. I both am excited by younger people, but also scared for them because
in all things, really.
Yeah. I just see a lot of media illiteracy happening.
Yeah.
And the fact that AI has kind of AI is probably like my biggest fear. And I don't want to put a blanket statement on AI, but I do think a lot of it in the way it's being hawked by people and certain people who have no artistic abilities or inclinations whatsoever scares the shit out of me. So, I don't know if that answered your question, but I feel like we're in a moment that is both exciting but also terrifying. That's the too long didn't read version.
That's more than sufficient for what we can say in the amount of time we have to say it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, on to more pleasant matters. What film did you select for us to discuss?
What have you film seen this movie?
Did you select for us to discuss today, Aisha?
I chose Splendor in the Grass.
This is Natalie Wood.
It sure is. I'm going to try to, I'm going to do my best not to be just embarrassing and spend an hour talking about how pretty Natalie Wood is. But goodness gracious.
Yeah.
What a striking young lady. All right, so this is your sort of...
I'm going to spend an hour talking about how pretty Warren Beatty is.
That's fair, too. Oh,
so
that's
beautiful.
Fair, too.
Lord
we
have
can
mercy.
Talk about all of both of...
How
both
did this
of
mannequin learn how to talk?
This is your classic mid-50s, early 60s, four-minute-long studio trailer. So we're gonna get to see a fair amount of the motion picture here. Full scenes. But yeah, there we are.
You like these weird old movies. Like, this
I
is...
do. What do you
not
mean?
You. I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about Aisha. I know what kind of movies you like.
You're right.
But you
You're
like these old, like... These sort of, you know, every time you come on the show, it's something I've never seen before, and I'm always like, we're watching what now?
Mm-hmm.
But it's great. Like, we had Lopez on to talk about Song Remains the Same, and, you know, she's usually talking about disability movies from her book and stuff like that. She just came on and talked about Robert Plant's pants for an hour. It was incredible. It was so good. I just, like, when I think pop culture happy hour lady, you know what I mean? I don't necessarily go straight to Splendor in the Grass, but I really like that you bring these movies.
I try.
Yeah, I really like it, yeah.
Yeah.
Look at that. The two of them are, we'll get into this, they're so hot together.
They're so, like, beautiful.
The
yeah.
movie, the entire success of everything in this movie is so reliant on us believing every second they're on screen together that they cannot keep their hands off each other.
Yeah.
Like, if Kazan had not cast the right actors with the right beauty and the right chemistry the whole movie falls apart.
Yeah.
And, like, credit where due. Every scene, I am convinced that they cannot keep their hands off of each other.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in real life, apparently they couldn't either, so.
Oh, really? Oh, oh, you got, see, I didn't do the gossip research on this, so it sounds like you might have some tea to share with us.
I mean, it's 60-plus-year-old tea, but yes. Yeah, They definitely had a fling, I think, on the set of this. But Warren Beatty had a fling with a lot of people on a lot of sets, so.
You know, rumor has it that betting his leading ladies was not an uncommon occurrence throughout Mr. Beatty's career, so I guess that happened right from the jump, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Yeah, see, like, entire scenes with silence, no music, no narration.
I mean, we complain about trailers being too long in theaters, but can you imagine this playing in a theater and it's just like... You just saw the whole movie.
That's what kills me when people start complaining about spoilers and trailers. I'm like, have you seen the trailers for some of these movies from the 50s? Holy shit.
Yeah. Although I do wonder when this trailer was put together. Like, I wonder if this was actually from that era.
I'm pretty sure this is the original trailer. Like, this kind of voiceover track... this use of
they're
text
not really
on
like
screen.
Replicating that for DVD releases in the 90s.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? That typical. Voiceover track is really the thing that jumps out almost more than anything else.
That's true. Yeah,
it's a guy who's but talking to you like this, as opposed to like in a world where kids are horny. You know, like you didn't really see that. Well, and introducing Warren Beatty, that kills me.
Yeah,
and I'm introducing. Not
get like too nerdy about this, but if you look at the text on screen, the way the titles and stuff come up, you can see that they're edited film, that they're not sort of like digital overlays.
That's
stuff like
true.
That. Like,
yeah,
that's like deep nerd shit that we don't need to talk about ever again.
This episode, we're gonna do some font nerding. That's what we're gonna do.
It feels very 60s to me.
Got it. Understood.
Yeah. I'm done. Enough nerd. Thank you.
Join Mike on his new podcast, Nerd Font. Splendor in the Grass was the first screenplay by Kansas-born, represent, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright William Inge. Four of his plays have been previously made into films, but adapted by other writers. This one was not based on a play. It was an original idea that Inge had pitched to director Ilya Kazan when Kazan was directing the Broadway production of Inge's play, The Dark at the Top of the Stairs. And Kazan encouraged him to write the screenplay. Inge was hoping to move into film work anyway while Splendor was in production. He told the New York Times, quote, "The problems connected with a play, not the writing of it, but in getting it properly presented, have become so great that I rather shudder at the thought of doing another one," end quote. Going back to our conversation about writing books, Aisha.
Yes.
Natalie Wood was cast in the female lead, and the film would be released, this blew my mind, 1 week before her other starring role of 1961 in a little picture called West Side Story. Not a bad stretch for Ms. Wood. The male lead was played, as we mentioned, by Warren Beatty, who had appeared in the Broadway production of Inge's play A Loss of Roses in 1959. It was his film debut. Kazan directed, dropping out of the Broadway production of Tennessee Williams, A Period of Adjustment, to do so. The film was shot between May and August of 1960, with various New York State locations standing in for Southeast Kansas, not altogether convincingly, and sets built at the Filmway Studios in East Harlem. 2 weeks into filming, Kazan, who had directed James Dean in East of Eden, told Variety of his new leading man, quote, "Jimmy Dean was nothing compared to what's going to happen when the kids see Warren Beatty," end quote. All right, Mike, what does Danny Perry say about Splendor in the Grass in Guide for the Film Fanatic?
Why do we got to be all in competition? You know, it's a long time to make a movie.
It does.
Guys, what, this doesn't...
Yes.
Yes. Can't we all get along? They made fun of him, but that's the realest shit anybody's said in my entire life.
You're right.
What were we doing?
Danny Perry's review. Perry. Capsule of Splendor in the Grass.
This is quite a review. William Inge scripted and Elia Kazan directed what is still the quintessential film about young love. First love, true love, eternal love. Which is wonderful, but terribly confusing while it lasts. Mercilessly cruel when it ends. This is also the first film that dared emphasize that teenagers are ruled by their sexual drives, and that because of their immaturity and inability to get practical information and advice from their parents, doctors, ministers, etc., they are unable to cope with their feelings. Story is set in 1920s in Kansas and centers on high school couple Warren Beatty, his debut, and Natalie Wood, who love each other madly but try desperately to hold off having sex until they are married. Unfortunately, Beatty's rich, domineering father, Pat Hingle, insists that his son go off to Princeton first, although Beatty would rather just marry Wood and be a dirt farmer, hoping Beatty will forget about the girl from the other poorer side of town. Beatty finds that house... That's the poor side of town.
I know.
I live wherever they're at.
They still had a little bit of shine on poverty back in 1961.
So yeah. Now I missed that the first time I watched it, where he's like, oh, well, she's poor, but we don't hold that against her. And I was like, bro, you can't hide in a poor house. What are they doing anyway? Sorry. I am transiting today. I'm sorry. I'm going to draw it back. I'm going to find my discipline. Beatty finds he is unable to control his sexual urges, but Wood protects her virginity, causing them to separate and Beatty to take up with the class tramp. Wood is heartbroken and angry because, just like Beatty's father, her own parents think her relationship with Beatty was merely puppy love and not to be taken seriously. And she offers herself to Beatty only to have him reject her because she is too good to have premarital sex. Wood has a breakdown and is sent to a mental hospital. Beatty goes off to college. Their love endures. Film still has impact. Kazan has tremendous sympathy for lovers and beautifully conveys their painful sexual frustration and confusion. Just by showing Wood walk through the empty school corridors, which had been full when she walked them before with Beatty, he clearly reveals the emptiness she feels inside.
Good catch.
Yeah.
Film perfectly captures feelings of most who have met former lovers years later and have been disappointed, as Wood is, by the person whom you were once obsessed with. Throughout the film, Kazan's direction of actors is superlative. Beatty is very controlled and sympathetic in his screen debut, but the film belongs to Wood, who has never been more ravishing, sexy, energetic, or revealing of her own personality. She obviously had a fix on her character. She later said she was going through feelings similar to those of the girl she played. Not only should this film have ended criticism of her acting, but Wood deserved an Oscar for her performance. Excellent, extremely moving film, has devoted following. Teenagers will love it. Also with Barbara Loden, Audrey Christie, Sean Gamson, Zora Lampert, Phyllis Diller.
Yes.
Diller? Yeah. Martine Bartlett and Gary Lockwood.
Okay. So that is one of the, like, that is a rare all-out rave for Mr. Perry.
Yeah, for real.
Who often at least, like, slides in those couple little tiny complaints at the end, at least, on something he likes. Nothing but good things to say about Splendor in the Grass. And frankly, I agree with him.
It just grows as it goes until she should have an Oscar and all this other business. Like, that's unusual for him.
So Aisha, tell us to start with, like, what is your personal history with this one? When did you first see it? What is your relationship with it been through your life?
I mean, well, so he said it right there. He's like, teens will love this. Mm-hmm. I was a teen when I saw this. I was a horny teen when I saw this movie. I'm 99% sure it was in my era of taping things off of TCM in the early 2000s when I was still in high school.
Love it.
And I had, you know, the way I found old movies was usually just by, like, following a star. And so I think I had seen Natalie Wood in West Side Story and maybe in, like, Miracle on 34th Street or something. And so West Side Story turned me and I was like, oh, I need to watch everything Natalie Wood has been in. And I still have not seen everything she's been in, but I've seen most of the stuff she was in her early career pre, like, the end, towards the end, like the late 70s and 80s. And I loved this movie. It spoke to me. Not that I grew up in, you know, sexually repressed Kansas in the 1920s, but I, you know, I grew up a teenager. I think at the time that I saw this, I had my first boyfriend. And so I was just like, very, oh, like, will we ever get time alone? And my parents were very strict and very like, you're not going to.
Your parents were like, no, you will not.
No, you will not. Probably for the better. But I loved this movie. I thought Warren Beatty was incredibly hot. I loved Natalie Wood in this. And I just feel like it's the type of movie that is, each time I've watched it since, it just grows and grows in terms of how it depicts teenage love, romance, mm-hmm. sexuality, but also really how awful parents can be about all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure we'll talk about it, but like the fact that, you know, all of these, the mother who is played by Audrey Christie, Frida, she says some, like, they're textbook hardcore Christian.
Women don't enjoy this.
Yeah, women don't enjoy it. Boys don't respect a girl they can go all the way with.
I wrote down the quote because I was like, okay, because this is the thing. Not only are these... The part of the reason you're responding to it the way you do as a teen in 2000 is that this is not period specific shit. No. Like, our society as a whole is probably less sexually repressed, I'm sure, than, you know, 100 years ago. But these ideas of male and female roles and the role that sex plays in those relationships, I mean, I don't know. You're younger than Mike and I. We are both 50 or nearly there. Hmm. But when I was a teenager, these ideas of girls who go all the way versus nice girls were still very much entrenched.
Not just that, but the idea that, like, girls don't, that, like, women don't enjoy sex.
Yeah.
That idea by itself was still very much present, that only dudes liked it at all. And that was normal, which also then tells you as a dude that if she doesn't like it, it's not your fault.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, this messaging is wrong in like so many, many, many ways.
No. A woman doesn't enjoy those things the way a man does. She just lets her husband come near her in order to have children. I am frankly embarrassed to say out loud how deep into my life I still believed that. Like, how deeply entrenched that messaging is throughout culture, that, like, that only men want sex, and therefore the woman has to be like a goalie, like a hockey goalie, to keep us all out, you know, and that's how the relationship works. Like, it's in there.
Yeah, I mean, look, I was watching this in the early 2000s, and so that was like a very confusing time as well, because it was like, on the one hand, women to some extent were encouraged to be more sexually forthright, but then they were still being scolded for it. Like, this was the era of Britney Spears dressing up in children's, or like in sort of like a schoolgirl's outfit while cuddling a stuffed animal and a phone on the Rolling Stone cover. Like, and this weird like virgin. And then when Christina Aguilera went dirty, it was like, oh, shocker. Like, so that was still very much in the culture, and to see this and see how, like, at that age in that time period, and know, like, oh, this goes deeper, this has been forever that people have thought this, and to see the way that this movie, you know, it's was filmed in the 60s, it's about the 20s, but like the time period it's in, which is like kind of post Elvis, but like pre heart, like full on sexual revolution.
Right.
It's still like surprisingly clear eyed about how much of this is the parents' fault and not theirs. Like, both of these kids wind up having to go to a hospital because they have nervous breakdowns. Like, it is, and they're extremes, right? They're huge extremes, but like at the same time, those extremes are so nuanced in the performances, and I'm sure we'll talk about Barbara Loden's character as well, as his sister in the movie. But like, she's probably the one part of this movie where I'm just like, I don't know. Like, especially her fate at the end of it, I'm just like, of course this is what happens to her.
Right.
But she also is like the rebel, and she's kind of the one who is like, you want to do everything daddy says, you go ahead, but I'm going to live my life. And does she live it too hard? Yeah, sure. But she does have a little bit more freedom, it seems. Fraught freedom, but she has a freedom that Bud does not have. And that's one thing I appreciate about it. And I love Barbara Loden in this. Like,
she's phenomenal. That party scene, man, like, gutting. Just, I mean, the bad girl is... a stand, like, from the beginning of, before they could be explicit about it. I mean, like, yeah. Louise Brooks and Pandora's Box. Like, this is one of the standbys of cinema. And it's a complex idea. And the great actresses who take it on are able to play that complexity. And she is certainly a great actress and certainly does that. She's and what was great for me was, and Mike, I think the same, I didn't see this until a couple of years ago, I want to say, and it was the same for you, right? Because we both watched it when Larry Karaszewski came on, mm-hmm. a very good year. He picked 1961 because it was the year he was born, and so this was one of his movies. So I had never seen it before. So, like, I when Barbara Loden's name came up, I'm like, oh, shit, it's Wanda, you know, and I got to be, like, excited to see her. Seeing it that late in life for the first time, you know, a very different experience from you seeing it as a teenager, kind of in the thick of it. I was very struck by the timelessness of it, by how much it mirrored high school sexuality as I remembered it, and the ideas, like we said, that are a part of what it presents that had not gone anywhere. And I don't think they were Kansas specific. I think they were all over the place.
First time we watched it, you're watching it and you're sort of consuming it and the whole thing, and you're seeing everything that they're doing, you know, and she's in the empty hallway and the whole thing. But this time, because I watched it again, you know, like,
yeah,
it was recently, but, you know, this is a serious thing. You know what I mean? You never know. And also, second viewings for me are usually really revelatory. I mean, it's usually, you know, and the thing that they got in this one that I didn't necessarily notice the first time but landed so hard is how whiny he is. Like, that's the thing. When I think about that time and being in that place, and this is one thing about being grown and seeing it, you know, like fully removed from that, is how just whingy and just bitchy you feel like you're, like, it's reasonable for you to say, like, this is a thing that you're supposed to do for me. Like, that is, like, an attitude that feels totally reasonable and justified when you're a 16-year-old boy. And I don't know how much of that is hormonal, how much of that is the culture telling you that this is a thing that you're supposed to do for me, even if you're not going to like it or whatever, blah, blah, blah. But that shit is super real. And I remember feeling that way and feeling like that was reasonable. And now when I think about it, it's just so embarrassing.
It's totally embarrassing.
It's horrifying to understand that you ever acted that way. And if it wasn't 30 years ago, you would want to call grown women and be like, look, I'm super sorry. That's right. I've come out. But like, you, that's the only thing you could do that would be more embarrassing.
I think we may have. I think we may have just hit on an idea for a bonus episode.
but they nailed that.
Mike and Jason make some apology calls. They did. They totally nailed it. Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because, like, I think he's whiny, not just because of that, but I also feel as though the Bud character is. He's not. Yes, he kind of expects these things, but at the same time, he kind of resists it too, just because he knows Deanie doesn't. Like, I think this movie, more than a lot of movies like this, like, really has two characters and shows how these things are affecting them equally.
Yes.
Like, in different ways, but, like, with equal amount of force, right?
Yes.
And so you see, like, he's, a lot of this is obviously coming from his dad, who's played by Pat Hingle, who I just learned for the first, I've seen this movie I don't know how many times, I just went down the Wikipedia rabbit hole. Only 13 years older than Warren Beatty?
Whoa!
What? The man, like, I mean, I know people age differently back then. My goodness, like.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, like, that entire thing, like, the scene where he is, he's trying to convince him to go to Yale, and he's like, you need to go to Yale, and also, like, there's good women, and there's other women, and you have fun with those women. And find
a girl to get a little steam out of your system.
Yes, and Bud is, like, kind of resisting. He's like, I don't really want to do that.
Yeah,
and I think
he thinks it's gross.
Yeah, and so I think that push and pull, like, it makes it very clear that, like, he doesn't necessarily expect it, but he thinks that he has to expect it because of his father. Yeah. And I think that's a different sort of thing than what we often see. And it makes him way more sympathetic because it's coming from inside the house, like literally inside the house. Like, that is what's happening. And so, especially that scene where they are, like, in, like, sneaking into her house while her mom isn't home, and then he, like, pushes her down and says, first of all, I'm like surprised that this got past the censors.
Same.
In 1961. I know.
Same.
Yeah, but like where he's like on your knees, slave, or something.
Yes.
It's like some really bad ADR going on there, but like it still it still works in that moment. Oh my goodness. It's just like, it's weird. But then after that scene, if you go back and rewatch it, it's like that happened. She starts crying and immediately he feels awful.
Yeah.
And like, it's such like hormones, man. Yeah, like the hormones, and then like they're almost like, then she's like, oh, okay, and and then they might start to do it again, but then her mom comes up. So like there's just so many layers to this back and forth dynamic of this like push and pull, and it is literally like sexual repression in human form in like the most dramatic way.
Yeah, no, action as storytelling, like, and the, and emotional action as well. I want to say a quick thing, just because you brought him up. Pat Hingle, I adore. I think, like, he really is one of these actors where, like, anytime he rolls in, even if it's just for a scene, I'm like, good to see you, Pat Hingle.
So good.
But the thing that I think is kind of lovely is that I got to meet Pat Hingle, and here's why. In Independence, Kansas, where William Inge is from, they used to do every year, they may still, I'm not sure, I haven't looked into it, and I should have before this, the William Inge Playwriting Festival. Every year, they would do a big event in William Inge's honor, where each year they would select a playwright and bring that playwright in and honor them and put together. Our friend Lonnie Quattlebaum was often the editor and the shooter of, like, a, you know, a tribute video where they would talk to famous actors who'd worked with them. They would present maybe one of their plays at this thing. And actors who had worked either with that playwright or with William Inge would come in every year and do like little workshops and things. And Pat Hingle came like every year because of his love for William Inge, specifically from doing this movie.
Wow.
And like when you hear that, just like the act of doing that is just sort of amazing. And this is in like 96. So like, I'm like, hey, it's Commissioner Gordon. Like, he was very exciting for a college kid. But I like, I went to a workshop and he was just, he was lovely, you know, and a character actor for so long that he just had wisdom all around him. You know what I mean? So I just want to throw that in. Shout out to Pat Hingle. God bless you. But
he brings a real like football coach energy to it.
He does.
You know, he brings a real like, I mean, and it's a, and in a way that like that part can be, and especially in, I mean, movies of this era, that part can be a straight up caricature.
Absolutely.
But he brings all the energy and all the gusto. He's a, you know, that guy. That guy's very hard to say no to.
Yeah.
Now imagine he's your dad.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and that's one thing about when I think about all these things, this, that's not my father. And that, the way he talks about women is not my father's relationship with my mother. Which means that I learned every stitch of this shit from outside the house.
Yeah.
And that is very impactful. That is something that hits me pretty hard, too, because you like to think of yourself as not that, right? As
right.
Like, how could I learn something that gross?
Right.
And not have it be an... at least you can immediately blame the guy.
Right.
You know, I learned it from watching you, right? But no, society taught me this, and then girls had to unteach me it.
Right.
And that's like a... I didn't expect this movie was much more confronting this time than last time.
And I like, Aisha, that you pinpointed to, and this hadn't really occurred to me, but you're 100% right. The equality of the storytelling in terms of the real estate in screen time and just emotionally that's given to both of those characters.
Yeah.
You know, that I think especially at this time it would have been very easy for it to have adopted probably more likely his, but you know, also we could have seen, you know, a version that was very much about her, a sort of women's picture, etc.
Right.
And that Inge gives them both sort of equal weight, equal agency and equal sympathy, I think, is really important. And especially once we get into sort of the back half of the movie where most of their scenes are apart.
Yeah.
And you really have to strike that balance of spending enough time with each of them and also to want to get back to the other one and not have either one of them overtake the narrative, I think is really admirable.
Yeah. What's interesting, I mean, it makes sense for the story, and this is very true. Like, I think it's notable the fact that, like, they both have nervous breakdowns, but only one of them gets sent to a psychiatric hospital.
Sure does. Right? Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it is mm-hmm. the woman.
Of course.
And
you women are really emotional. You know,
we're hysterical, as they like to say. You know. But
there's a cure for that if they just would have left him alone. Anyway.
I know. It's but that is also fascinating to me because, like, first of all, I think that scene in the bathtub with Natalie Wood is, like, it's forever seared in my memory. Like, that is...
Yeah,
one of my favorite moments in a movie ever, and just the moment where her mom is like, "Did he spoil you?" And she's like, "I'm not spoiled." And she's like, "Going," she's, it's just so fantastic. But then when she gets to the hospital, and you see her, like, you see all different types of people there. You see old people there. You see men, women. She meets her fiance there, and there's just such a gentleness to the way that they approach this, like. It is not, as they would say, director. It's not like the loony bin, quote unquote. They're treating this as a place where she can actually get better. Yeah. And they also make it very clear that getting better is in part about being away from her mother, really, her parents. Mm-hmm. I think the way we see that final scene with her and her mom, it's so complicated in that, like, her mom is asking. I've known so many people like this who have. Especially parents, not my parents, but like other people's parents who expect them to forgive them, quote unquote, or to not blame them for the things that have happened to them when it's like, oh no, this, you are the source of my problems. Mm-hmm. But the way that Deanie approaches it is she's just like, it's better not to fully engage. I also think she feels kind of complicated about it. She's totally. Like, I love you, but also I'm going to say what you want me to say, you know, so that I don't have to deal with you as much, and she's gonna move away. She's gonna move to the, you know, a different state. I think that's subtle, but it's very notable how it feels like this movie could have been made today because it has that sort of like, in this age of quote unquote therapy speak and all those things. Like it has that sense of that without feeling didactic. It just feels natural in a way.
Yeah. No, that's a really good point. And and it's dealt with your, like it's very easy to talk about how, you know, sort of the candor of the sexual material makes it feel very contemporary. But you're right. That scene, frankly, not a lot of movies now would get that scene right the way that this one does. Like it's really intense and complicated and nuanced and kind of beautiful. Speaking of, before we wrap up this section, we got to spend a few minutes on that last scene. I'm when it came time to watch it again, that was the main thing that had lingered for me from that first viewing. Like we spent, I think most of the time we had allotted to talk about this movie with Larry talking about this last scene. It is incredible. I mean, perfect filmmaking that on every directorial choice is just right. The writing is incredible. Every single performance is so heart-wrenching, including his wife, including her friends.
Angelina, yeah.
I am in awe of what's happening in this scene. The way that they look at each other the first time they see each other again, the way her face absolutely falls when she gets her first look at Bud Jr., how her eyes are closed when she's holding him, and the way that, God, Kazan fucking sucked politically, but God, what a filmmaker.
I know.
His face, or the way he frames, that he puts the camera in front of her face a view that no one else in the room has as she is walking out of that room.
Oh my God, yes.
And the entire scene's power rests on the fact that we are stealing looks at her, at the reactions that she is hiding from everyone else, but not from the camera. It is wrenching. It tears you to pieces. And I'm sorry. I start talking about this scene and I just talk and talk and talk, but it's a beautiful, it's a perfect conclusion in every single way. And when I, and the whole time I was watching it again, I was like waiting for it to come back because I'm like, oh, gotta cry coming up. Here it comes.
Yeah. It's one of those scenes where like you feel for every character.
Every character.
You feel for Bud. You feel for Deanie. You also feel for Angelina because she's just like,
she knows.
Like he's like, this is my friend. Who knows if he's told her about Deanie, but like you can tell that she's just like, I'm making space for you, but also, why are you in my house? Like,
yeah. Yeah. Like,
but it just feels so real. And like, I remember the first time I watched this, I think I was probably around 14 years old. And so I was getting into old movies. I was getting into more different kinds of movies than what I was used to, but I don't think I had ever seen, this is one of the first where the ending is really bittersweet, where it's mm-hmm. like, I think I thought up to that point that they would somehow find their way
back
to each
other. Of course they'll
get
back. Of course they're going to end up together. It's right. A romance.
Right. And
it's
so
a romance from Hollywood's golden age. Of course they're going to ride off into the sunset together.
Yeah, you think that if you're, you know, 14 and that's all you've known is that's how movies end. And it's just so mature the way this happens. And you're so right about like that shot of her like trying to compose herself. Like everyone here is putting on a face.
Absolutely.
And you see moments where that you can see behind that, and you can see the pain, and you can also see the just like relief of finally being able to let go in a way. And I also like this time on this rewatch, I was struck by how they talk about happiness at the end. And, you know, and he's like, I don't think too much about happiness. Or she's like, I don't think too much about happiness either. And he's like, what's the point? You got to take what comes.
Take what comes.
Oh, my God. Like, the fact that, like, maybe they aren't happy. And how much did that, like, I'm sure the therapy helped. But, like, there's still so much trauma left there. Mm-hmm. So it's like they're not fully over the hill or the hump, but I do think
they've just resigned themselves.
Yeah, they've resigned themselves. That's sort of the bittersweet part of it, besides them not getting back together. But oh man, I mean, what you mentioned West Side Story, and one of the things that's really interesting about this movie is the fact that while this was being made, the producers of West Side Story asked to see early shots of the film because they were looking for Warren Beatty for Tony.
Oh. But oh dear.
Then they decided, well, no, but Natalie Wood.
Yeah.
She's perfect for Maria. Now, we don't have to talk about, I love West Side Story, but she's very miscast in that movie.
Sure.
For various reasons.
Sure.
But like, this to me is such a perfect role for her. And it really did sort of mark that transition from like child performer and, you know, Rebel Without a Cause and all that stuff in The Searchers to, okay, now like up next, we've got Sex and the Single Girl and this Gypsy like, you know.
This is an actor. This is a grown up now.
Yeah.
Is this her from the ones that you have seen, because you know, I know you mentioned that you didn't do the full filmography, but it sounds like you've seen the essentials. Is this her best performance?
I think it might be. I would have to go back and rewatch Bob and Ted, and because
that's the only other contender I had.
Because I have not seen that in years, and I've only seen it once in full. So I feel like I would have to go back and rewatch that.
Good. But not a dissimilar in terms of the complexities of what she's doing.
Yeah.
They're kind of good bookends, I think, maybe.
Yeah, I would definitely say this is at least two, if not one. Yeah. And I would say she's also like really great in Rebel Without a Cause, but she's not necessarily the central focus there in the same way. So yeah, no, I just I freaking love this movie so much, man.
It's great. No, I'm glad as hell you gave us an excuse to watch it again. Okay, let's take a quick break, and then we will talk about the movie's release and reception.
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
All right, friends, let's talk about the release and reception of Splendor in the Grass, which opened on October 10th, 1961 in New York City, alongside Town Without Pity, Backstreet, The Explosive Generation, The Honeymoon Machine, and King of Kings. Also playing in New York City that week, Breakfast at Tiffany's, Spartacus, The Hustler, La Dolce Vita, Blood and Roses, Fanny, Purple Noon, Never on Sunday, and Breathless. Mike, what were the news headlines on that day?
I've never heard of any of those movies. Too bad none of them made an impression on the world. October 10, 1961 saw the merger of the Glenn L. Martin Company with the American Marietta Corporation to create the Martin Marietta Corporation. And they were later name-checked in a Fugazi song about corporate malfeasance, creating one of the most surreal scenes in the 1990s when a bunch of dirty kids in clubs chanted Lockheed, Lockheed, Martin Marietta over and over. It was a very weird... It made sense why they put it in the song, but then all of these kids being like, Lockheed, Lockheed, Martin Marietta, like it sounded, it didn't make any sense. Very odd. That is completely not important. But that's the thing that jumped out at me.
Sure.
If we're being honest about the news on this day. Syria became a country on October 10, 1961.
Hey, good for them.
Breaking away from Egypt.
All right.
Okay, now I'm going to read a little bit from the newspaper. Okay. I don't usually do that. But this is and you two are writers. You will appreciate that this is unusual writing for a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
I think, right?
We've both written in this very newspaper, in fact.
Oh. Okay. Now, imagine writing this and trying to get them to publish it now.
Okay, ready? I'm ready. Quote. I'm ready.
It is rare in this difficult and tumultuous era for a crisis to be handled with wisdom and restraint by all the factions and powers concerned. Thus far, Syria's breakaway from Egypt has evoked a maximum of good sense. President Nasser's first and understandable reaction was to send paratroopers, rave on the radio, and threaten to break relations with the countries that began to recognize the government in Damascus. But he made a quick recovery and speedily accepted the development with statesmanship and good grace. I mean, like, it's this, it almost sounds like Nasser's PR person wrote it or something. It's a very weird story.
All right.
And also, it's not about Syria.
Right.
Which is a new country that got created out of the What a weird story.
No, we focus squarely on the colonizers, you know. that's a constant. Yeah.
Syria's been great. No news from
Nothing.
Syria ever.
No problems. No problems.
And finally, there's a very short piece about Dizzy Gillespie, who okay. Might as well be my grandfather.
Absolutely.
All right, as much as I love this guy.
Yeah.
There's a very short piece about Dizzy Gillespie being denied use of a swimming pool in Kansas City because he was black. And I think that it's important to point out that, one, that was still happening to people when Warren Beatty was starring in movies. But also that, two, it ever happened to a stone-cold superhuman like Dizzy Gillespie. How could you possibly look at Dizzy Gillespie and tell him he can't do anything on this earth? You can see that man's soul from across the street.
Right.
Anyway... And also, three, it somehow made the New York Times. It's like a sentence and a half. So did it make the Times because he was famous? Or is this like a sympathetic editor or writer? It's 1961. It's just very confusing. It's maybe the most confused I've ever been by a sing. And like frustrated. And like, and then, but also by the end, he's like, obviously I'm going to sue these sons of bitches. So
good.
I felt better. It was like this. It was like two sentences that just sent me
a real
so
roller coaster for you, huh?
Yeah. So that happened October 10th, 1961. Weird news day.
All right.
Jason, what did the critics say about Splendor in the Grass?
For the New York Times, Bosley Crowther wrote, quote, Mr. Inge has written and Mr. Kazan has hurled upon the screen a frank and ferocious social drama that makes the eyes pop and the modest cheek burn. I believe we could safely say if anybody had modest cheeks, it was Bosley Crowther. Petting is not simply petting in this embarrassingly intimate film. It is wrestling and chewing and punching that end with clothes torn and participants spent. And boozing is not simply boozing with adults and also with kids. It is swilling and reeling and hollering and getting disgustingly sick. But where these might sound exaggerations and seem sensationalisms in other films, they are reasonable, plausible, convincing, and incisively significant here. End quote.
That's the most I've ever liked Bosley Crowther's complaining.
Same, right? Yeah. In the Los Angeles Times, Philip K. Schauer opined, the picture does have its theatrical excesses and falls short idealistically in that its morality remains unresolved. Nevertheless, it is filmmaking of the first order and one of the few significant American dramas we have had this year. End quote. Hmm. Variety was a little more measured in its praise. Quote, Ilya Kazan's production of William Inge's original screenplay covers a forbidding chunk of ground with great care, compassion, and cinematic flair. Yet there is something awkward about the picture's mechanical rhythm. There are missing links and blind alleys within the story. Too much time is spent focusing on characters of minor significance. End quote. Not sure I agree with that. But the frankly usually reliable Dwight McDonald of Esquire really whiffed on this one, claiming Kazan was, quote, as vulgar a director as has come along since Cecil B. DeMille, end quote. Take that however you'd like. Reminder, came out the same day as King of Kings. And insisting, quote, I've never been in Kansas, but I suspect that parents there, even way back in 1928, were not stupid to the point of villainy, and that their children were not sexually frustrated to the point of lunacy. And to that I say, Mr. McDonald, you are wrong.
Oh my goodness.
Kazan
unless there
is,
was this window between then and the 90s where that wasn't real because...
Yeah. Kazan, he says, is forthright the way a butcher is forthright when he slaps down a steak for the consumer's inspection. He won't give up anything that can be exploited, end quote. Dwight McDonald, you're kind of dead to me now. All right, how did it do in terms of box office and awards, Mike?
That guy was the maddest of everybody except Hayes when the Hayes Code went away. He was second of the mads.
That sounds about right.
Wow. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the nice things about film journalism before the 80s is that box office wasn't really reported as the sort of horse race that we do now, right?
Right,
we have no idea how this movie did at the box office. It probably did great. Everybody kept working. Warren Beatty got to be in other stuff.
Yep.
I will note that it was enough of a success to warrant a 1981 TV movie remake. And I love you guys, but I'm not doing it.
Yes. That's not what I have not watched it. I don't know.
Well, I'm not sure how exciting Melissa Gilbert and Cyril O'Reilly were in the leads. I think we can all agree that Ned Beatty in the Pat Hingle role and Michelle Pfeiffer in Barbara Loden might be worth checking out. All right. You might turn me around.
Might have to check that out.
In terms of awards, Inge won the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay.
Hey.
Nice.
Not bad for his first time out.
Yeah.
While Wood was nominated for Best Actress, but that prize went to Sophia Loren for Two Women, also beating out Audrey Hepburn for Breakfast at Tiffany's, Piper Laurie in The Hustler, and Geraldine Page in Summer and Smoke. So,
yeah,
I feel that was sort of a...
Yeah.
A little stacked.
Tough group.
Yeah.
Wood was also nominated for a BAFTA and a Golden Globe. The Globes also nominated Beatty for Best Actor and the movie for Best Picture Drama, but the only Globe it took home was to Beatty for Most Promising... newcomer.
I mean, they kind of nailed it.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
All right, now it's time for a segment we call Double It Up.
Better than Jimmy Dean.
where we each select one movie that we think would make an ideal double feature with today's focal film. Aisha, you're our guest, which means you go first.
Okay, I struggled with this because I didn't want to pick something that was too obvious. I like a double feature where... It's not quite as it doesn't make as much sense on the surface, but I ultimately came down with Dee Reese's Pariah. So this is like a different kind of sexual repression.
No, that's great though. Yeah.
Of course, this is the film starring Adepero Oduye as a teenager who is. She's exploring her sexuality. I think she might be queer, and this does not. this does not go over well with her mom, who's played by Kim
Wayans. it's a real bad mom's double feature.
Bad moms, and also like the fathers in both of these movies, the father of Natalie Wood's character, and in Pariah, they're also way more sympathetic, I think, which is another trope that we can dig into at another time. But sure. Kim Wayans is a hardcore Christian and super strict, and I think that this sort of like other side of the sexual repression, where it's like, yes, it's all sex, but also especially sinful, quote unquote, sex in terms of queerness, is, I think, really interesting to look at. And you can see how the more things change, the more things stay the same. They're, you know, they're set in different time periods completely. But I love Pariah. I think it's so great. And I think that would be a good double feature with this.
Good call. That's a really good call. I went with something a little more on the nose, as my double features tend to be, but I really like Antonia Bird's Mad Love, which came out in 1995 with Drew Barrymore and Chris O'Donnell, the latter of whom I usually do not like at all. But I like him in this movie. And part of that is, it's kind of similar to what we were talking about during the trailer. Like, that is a movie about teens who are crazy about each other, who just want to be together, whose parents don't want them to be together, et cetera, et cetera. It is the 90s, so like the to fuck or not to fuck is not as big of a deal. But then it kind of takes it to the next level. Like, what happens when like you lose your virginity to someone, and like sort of the emotional attachment that comes with that and the intensity of that. So the connection really to me is sort of the intensity of the chemistry between the two leads. And like we were talking about earlier, how the whole movie fails or succeeds based on that.
Yeah.
And the two of them are terrific together. Drew Barrymore, I've talked about my Drew Barrymore thing plenty of times before, but I love her so much. She's 1 year older than me, so I've like grown up with her. And I think this is low-key one of her best performances. Like, she is playing someone who has some sort of some psychological damage, who has layers, who has the sort of like party girl exterior with a lot of wounds underneath that. She plays it real. She does not play it as the cliche it can very easily be. And I think Antonia Bird is a really underrated director who did a lot of good work in the 90s. Mad Love. That's mine. Mike, what about you?
All right.
Oh, God.
When we did 1961 with Kara Zuski, I recommended like La Jetée or some shit like that.
Okay, sure.
Something.
Sure.
Something that's fine. But it yes. You don't got to do that every week.
Sure.
So this week, I'm subject to do that every week. But this sure. week, instead, I'm going to say another movie from 1961. Watch The Absent-Minded Professor. Now.
Okay.
There's two reasons. There's two reasons why we're pulling down The Absent-Minded Professor.
Okay. One, this is Fred McGuire, right? I think I've seen this. Okay.
It sure is. Yeah.
Because it's worth watching on its own. I mean, sure. You're not going to build your personality around it. You know what I mean? But like, it is fun. But the other thing is, watch The Absent-Minded Professor and then go for a walk or have some lunch or something. Give yourself a moment. You know what I mean? Then come back, make a coffee, and put on a real fucking movie and appreciate what they were doing here. I think that this is one of those things where, like, this movie just sort of all by itself out of the context of 1961 is it's a little bit, you know, it's not quite as stark as it could be. And this was one thing when we watched it last time. We were watching it, you know, Kara Zuski brought 5 movies, right?
No, he brought 10. We asked him for 5 and he brought us 5 double features.
Obviously
he
did. That's why you love Uncle Larry.
Overachiever.
Of course.
But, like, but when you were, and those were all good movies.
They were all
like,
good.
You know, but they were also not all the beasts with 1,000 eyes. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like they were, so that was one thing that watching this movie in the context of 1961, I think actually made a difference last time.
Yeah.
Whereas this time it sort of stood out. It felt a little bit more personal. Like I'm saying, I recognized a little bit of my own young self in there, things like that. Right. But in the context of 1961, I think that how much, the time allotted to both characters, the sort of all the stuff that we've talked about, how much that stands out
Yeah.
And so Absent Minded Professor is not on Karaszewski's list, but it's kind of the most.
It's a real 1961 movie.
Version of that thing that I'm. Of the point that I'm trying to make. You know what I mean? It will take you as far away from this as you can get while still staying in the ballpark.
There you go. Nice.
And it ain't Logite, buddy. Let me tell you
that. Aisha, where can people follow you on social media and read your work and hear you and plug away?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at AHA88. I don't post that often, but you know, sometimes you can follow my work there, and also Blue Sky, Aisha Harris. And then of course on NPR, Pop Culture Happy Hour, we, you know, we're four hosts doing our best to go through the pop culture that is currently, currently happening. And also sometimes we do some evergreen stuff. So yeah, that's where you can find me.
Oh, and they can find you on Letterboxd as well.
Oh, right. I totally forgot. I'm on. It's funny. Like, that's a thing now. I just started getting into Letterboxd. Yes, I am on Letterboxd. I don't remember what my handle is. But if you...
we'll link to it. Yeah, we'll link to it.
Yeah, I have too many different handles. Ah, yeah.
No, I found you on there the other day, and I was like, hey, she just watched Splendor in the Grass. Look at that.
Okay. I am Jason Bailey
on Letterboxd and also Blue Sky. Mike, where can people find you?
Michael Hull on Letterboxd while we're doing our Letterboxd thing. I just joined a few months ago, too, and I really like it.
It's fine.
Yeah, yeah. You can escape the horrors for a while on it.
I haven't seen a single opinion about anything currently happening in politics or healthcare, gun rights. Not a single word of it. It's great. Ukraine doesn't even exist. Great.
And of course,
Ukrainian movies, just not
wars. There you
go.
Absolutely.
You know what I
mean? Absolutely. Yeah. Of course, if you like the show and think other people might like it too, please do leave us a rating and or a review on your podcatcher of choice. If you'd like to join our mailing list and get weekly show notes and links and all the things we've referenced in today's show, you can do that at buttondown.email/filmfanatic. If you'd like to make a donation to support us and the show, you can do that at ko-fi.com/funcitysounds. And of course, if you like YouTube, if you, for whatever reason, like watching people talking into microphones on YouTube, we do have a channel there. You can find us on YouTube at Guide for the Film Fanatic. You'll see all of us. You'll see us on our microphones. You'll see pictures. You'll see the trailer while we're watching it. It's a good little, you know, I don't know. I would never watch a podcast on YouTube, but a lot of you do. So you can do that there.
Jason has very expressive hands. Aisha has very expressive lips. And I am wearing a funny hat. So... there you go. Check it out. Our humblest thanks to our guiding light, Mr. Danny Perry, author of Guide for the Film Fanatic. And shout out to executive producer Blake Howard. You know, I was telling Blake that I feel kind of out of place here in Portland. It was so strange. He just barked. That's because you peroxide your hair and paint your face up like an Indian.
Thank you again, Aisha.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening.